Welcome to another edition of the 51%, Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein. A personal thought from award-winning playwright, journalist, author, Cindy Cooper. I don't know if it's possible to change the world with words, but I believe that it's worth giving it a try. Well, my guest today has done more than try. An overview. So far in her career, Cindy has written 14 full-length plays, including How She Played the Game, about six women from sports history, Silence Not, a love story, about a Jewish woman and Catholic man who raised their voices against the rise of Nazism and lived to tell about it, and most recently, Stones of Tiananmen, which looks at how China's jailed Nobel Peace Laureate deals with the limits of freedom of speech and his own conscience in the years following the massacre at Tiananmen Square. Her oeuvre also includes more than 20 one-act plays. Cindy is the author of several nonfiction books, including Cheating Justice, How Bush and Cheney Attacked the Rule of Law, and Mockery of Justice, the true story of the Dr. Sam Shepard murder case. As a journalist, she writes frequently about social justice and human rights, and her articles have appeared just about everywhere and then some, among them The Nation, Ms., Marie Claire, and the National Law Journal. Cindy is a member of the Dramatists Guild Women's Initiative, the Authors Guild, serves on several nonprofit boards, volunteers for social justice causes, and teaches strategic communications at Columbia University. A cum laude graduate of Cleveland State University, Cindy has a law degree from Emory University. And that's it, Cindy. Welcome, and thanks for joining me today.
Thank you. Sounds like someone else.
Well, it's you. When did you realize you had a lot to say?
I think I felt compelled to write at a very young age, mostly because my siblings went off to school and I was left home alone. So the only way I could communicate was I'd sit in a corner and write.
And what'd you write about back then?
I don't remember that early, but I remember around when I was around 11 or 12, my older brother brought home a mimeograph machine that was discarded by his fraternity. He was quite a bit older. He was in college then. So I quickly turned this into a neighborhood newspaper where I started going around interviewing people and talking to them and printing it, writing my stories, printing it, and then distributing it door to door. So I just wanted to communicate at that very, very young age and became dedicated to it. Sometimes I look back and I was in a playwriting workshop one time that I was leading, and I was doing a pairing with someone, and she was asking me about her character, and the question she asked is, what did you want to do when you were young? And I was like, I wanted to be a writer. And here I was. So it was pretty amazing.
It's fascinating. Writing was obviously something that you could do, and I guess you knew you could do it.
I think early on from teachers, I remember my sixth grade teacher telling me to dedicate my first novel to her. I haven't really written a novel, so I dedicated a nonfiction book.
I was going to say, did you get off the hook? But what's interesting is that you had this affinity for writing, but then, of course, I read that you went to Cleveland State University where you majored in urban studies. What does that have to do with writing?
Well, I was at Cleveland State University. They didn't actually have, it was a brand new university, and I was going to night school. Uh-huh. I was working at a newspaper in the day. And they actually didn't have a journalism program.
But did you need a journalism program if you were already getting paid for doing that?
Well, I did my first year at the University of Missouri, and I thought, but I found out you couldn't get into the journalism program till the third year. I don't knock journalism programs, but I think finding out everything you can about the world and cultivating curiosity is equally as important. And so urban studies was a wonderful program because we studied economics, we studied social issues, we studied the environment.
You covered a lot of territory.
Each has equal components. You had to complete all those components. And I was working at an urban newspaper, so it really helped my journalism as well.
What did you do for the newspaper?
I was a reporter. We were assigned communities. Although I'm white, this was an African-American newspaper, mm-hmm. and I was the only white reporter. But I covered Huff, which was a ghetto area, and Collinwood. We were assigned neighborhoods. And so I just covered everything in that area from the opening of a community center mm-hmm. to I did a story that won a little award about the old houses in Huff that had been maintained and built up by the community and things that the community board was doing, a wonderful community center and anti-drug program, and there was just a lot going on.
You kind of did this on your own, didn't you?
Well, everybody built on, you know, a community of other people. I can't say that I did anything really on my own, but...
Well, could I go to a newspaper and say, hire me?
It does take a lot of determination and drive. And in fact, when I first went there, they didn't hire me because they didn't think I was dressed appropriately for the community. I was wearing jeans. So I came back in a dress, and I wore a skirt or a dress every mm-hmm. day because they felt that was more appropriate for the community. But I was determined to work there. I really wanted to do it. I loved the idea that I wrote 700 stories there, I think.
Really?
So I loved the idea that we were expected to have this really high output. We took our own pictures as well.
Did you do your own stories or were you assigned stories back then?
Both. Mm-hmm. And we were asked to come up with enterprise stories as well. And I did another one that won a little award about it was black on black crime, something we didn't really talk about, but, you know, looking at that, parts of the community came in and went through all the crime statistics. And another one I did that I just happened upon was at the women's workhouse, the inferior conditions, really, at the women's workhouse, where they didn't have, like, working bathrooms. It was really pathetic. And that was maybe my first little inkling that you could make a change through writing, because after they were upset, and they started to do some modifications.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you go from there to Emory Law School, and why?
Well, that's the other thing, is I always had this strain of activism, and there wasn't really a model for a journalist activist that I knew of. So I felt like I either had to be a journalist or an activist, and I had been covering some things in the courts, the federal courts, civil rights laws, and I had a wonderful constitutional law professor and who had actually argued cases in the U.S. Supreme Court and on criminal law. And I just was really fascinated by that whole area. So I decided, you know, I was going to go to law school. And I thought at the time I would be a lawyer. I would be a constitutional lawyer like my professor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just kept moving in that direction for a little while.
But you never really practiced, did you?
I practiced for a couple of years right after law school. I talked to some journalism organizations, and actually I talked to probably the only existing network journalist at the time, and he said, you need to practice because it's so different from law school.
Right.
But that wasn't really why. I got a scholarship. I got a community fellowship called the Reginald Heber Smith Community Lawyer Fellowship. They sent you somewhere. They sent me to Minnesota to work for a legal services organization, which is in Minnesota meant civil law, and in some places it means criminal, but civil law. And so I did practice there. I started a couple of programs. It was because they didn't have to pay my salary. I had a little more latitude than some of the staff lawyers. So I started a program for women at a women's center called Legal Assistance for Women, or LAW. And I started another program at Legal Services, and both of these still exist, called Community Legal Education. And that's where I started bringing the journalism back, because as I started talking to our clients, I realized they knew so little, and they didn't even come with the right papers. Huh. There was no information for them. There was just, you know, there was a phone answering system, but there just was... You know, until they got to the office, there was nothing for them. I mm-hmm. mean, it was before there were websites. There weren't even, like, regular publishers really publishing information for...
So you saw this real need here.
Right. So I proposed that we start this community program where we start publishing materials about the law. So we published several books called... They were called People's Rights. It was People's Rights and housing law, so how to deal with your landlord, things that people might be able to do on their own. Some of them were things like, if you're coming in for an appointment about family law, this is what you need to bring, just to facilitate their process.
Sure.
And then we also had a series of community organizers, and we went out to the community and talked about, gave lectures, you know, about landlord-tenant law, mm-hmm. or welfare, making an appeal on a welfare case, or Section 8, and just trying to get the community to help each other and, you know, help themselves as much as they could without abrogating our own duties as lawyers.
And that sort of morphed into more journalism
right,
for you.
Right, exactly.
So then came articles and books.
Correct.
Give us the genesis of the Bush-Cheney book.
The Bush-Cheney book. Well, that follows another book called The Impeachment of George W. Bush, which I co-wrote with Elizabeth Holtman. And the same thing with the cheating justice. And so a president cannot be prosecuted while, I can say he, because there hasn't been a
exactly.
woman president.
Yes. Yeah.
While he is in office. But after he is in office, a president can be prosecuted. There's never actually been a case, but Nixon was an unindicted co-conspirator.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So that's the precedent. So we wanted to look at what could he actually be prosecuted for, just so that no one could say there wasn't a possibility of it. Then we had to live up to our responsibilities as citizens
mm-hmm.
or as a government. You know, why were we not taking action? One curious thing is after we started writing the book, we found out that Bush and Cheney had done a number of things to protect themselves from prosecution. So that they were quite aware
mm-hmm.
that they were transgressing the law in a number of areas and took active steps, inserting little teeny additions to laws that you had to read through, you know, was added to Law A, but it applied to Law B, and Law B applied
to
Law
C. So the average Joe would be clueless about
exactly.
all of this stuff.
I think more than the average Joe. I mean, Congress was clueless. And it was,
well, let's not even go there.
So it was just an effort to look at what could be done. And the thing is I was able, I guess, to draw upon my legal background because a lot of that I consider to be translating for
mm-hmm.
a lay public, although this, you know, is also quite thick, I guess. But translating what the law says, what the history is, what the precedent is, and then applying it to this area of Bush and Cheney and whether they had broken the law.
And?
They did break the law in a number of areas. They also passed laws to protect themselves from being prosecuted.
So your book is out here, but they're completely home free.
Well, there was just this weekend a decision from the European Court of Human Rights that the Bush-Cheney regime had engaged in torture as defined legally. So we looked at several areas. We looked at electronic surveillance, and now we see that so much of what had been done under Bush, which was carried on by Obama, is coming to light. We looked at torture, and that, I mean, it seemed obvious that the United States was engaged in torture, and yet there was this unwillingness to look at what the United States had done, and it's not just waterboarding. It's a series of actions that were approved by our own government, including putting somebody in a small box where they had to crouch, a television box, putting them in a box for days with a bug that would freak them out. So there was a whole lie about that. And another area we looked at was lying to Congress about the need for war.
In Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And so that has come more to light. So I think maybe there's a hope that as a country, we will learn some lessons. We will improve our democratic system or at least have our eyes a little bit more
mm-hmm.
open the
mm-hmm.
next time around. So I won't say nothing has happened, but at least, you know, we have some markers to
gotcha.
Look at.
If you're just joining us, my guest today is Cindy Cooper, who is a journalist, author, and playwright. You know, Cindy, it's one thing to write articles. It's another thing to research and write books. But plays, isn't that just a whole other ballgame? And just as an aside, a bunch of years ago, I had a show on public radio, and one of my guests was Wendy Wasserstein with Christopher Durang and Paul Rudd. conversation was getting a little too inside baseball at one point. And finally, I just looked at Wendy and I asked her, how do you write a play?
Good question. And the first thing is you have to sit down.
Nobody likes a smart ass.
No. I think I had worked in television a bit. And so that gave me an idea about how to visualize stories. And
television journalism?
Yes.
Okay.
I decided to take a year off, and I started exploring playwriting. And it was very exciting to me because to get people in a room, to be live with them, to see, I think theater offers, unlike any other form of communication, a possibility for people to transform. Because it reaches them at an emotional level and an intellectual level. So you're reaching the heart and the mind.
So it's visceral.
Yes. People bring their own experiences to the theater. So they're thinking while they're watching, they're engaged, they're crying, they're laughing. Mm-hmm. And so it has a possibility to create a tsunami. Because it changes people internally. And that's been one of my big questions is how do you get someone to change? Through so many of the things I researched, it's so hard. People, when you show them A, B, C, D are all wrong, they're flawed, they're illegal, they will stick by them. Mm-hmm. But through the theater, when people experience the human side of a story, and that's what I've tried to focus on, the human side of human rights.
So it's transformative for somebody in the audience.
A lot of people want to be engaged. They want to expand their thinking. And the theater is a way to do that.
So what was your first play?
My first play was called Dirty Laundry. And mm-hmm. It was about several people at a laundromat. And there was someone who was committing a sexual impropriety. A slasher. The lights would go out. It was my first play, so it had lots of flaws. All plays have lots of flaws, but it had more. But it was an effort to talk about the criminalization of sexual behavior, when it's appropriate and when it's inappropriate. And like a lot of things I write, they also talk about reconciliation and forgiveness, which is something we don't get a lot through our journalism.
Did it come easily to you to sit down and write a play? Did it flow?
It was very exciting to me. And I don't know if this is a good or bad thing, but the first play I wrote won an award and I got a fellowship, mm-hmm. which was renewed for a second year. So it fortunately or unfortunately encouraged me to continue this process, which is extraordinarily difficult. But I wouldn't say it came easy because nothing comes easy, but it came with a great deal of emotional and intellectual energy.
And commitment.
And commitment because it's so rich. I mean, you're working alone and then you're working in collaboration. One of the things about journalism is you're working alone almost all the time.
Right. Now, you said, this is a quote, in the theater, the audience is everything to me. I strive to touch the audience, to enrich them with the opportunity to see things differently. With stylized realism, my plays, comic and dramatic, are about society, women overcoming obstacles, and finding transformation. Expound on that.
Let me start with the audience, because the audience is one thing that probably unites all of my writing and also the teaching that I do at Columbia, is understanding where people are and what they need to know, and then how to communicate that to them. So that's why I consider writing in a way to be a little bit of translation. Mm. It's like taking in tons and tons of information and then finding a way to communicate it to people in a way that the target group can understand it.
So digesting it.
Right. Mm-hmm. And making it interesting,
right.
Hopefully.
Right.
I think of theater as the same way. So it's kind of trying to understand what people know and they don't know and how to make that into a story that filters through characters. I tend to focus, not always, but I do tend to focus on topics that haven't been addressed. Whether it's writing for women performers who don't normally get roles. Sometimes They are pieces that are leftovers from something else I've worked on. I have a little short play that's performed a lot that's about the death penalty, and it's a woman lawyer who's talking to the mother of a victim. And it is, I hope, it gives people some emotional content. It also might give them some information about the death penalty and also a little possibility for rethinking things, that transformation.
Mm-hmm. I just recently interviewed two women, one of whom is a director, the other is an actress, involved in this play, Life Without Parole. It's testimonies and transcripts from inmates at the California Institution for Women at Chino who were convicted of killing their abusive partners. Now, somebody may say, why do I need to go see this? To me, this would be just riveting theater. And to hear from an underserved population, and from people who don't usually have a voice. So my guess is that you're giving voices to certain groups.
To certain groups and to certain ideas as well. Because one of the things that theater can do is it can have a ripple effect, hopefully. And so those women that are in prison under those circumstances are definitely, they're people, for example, that I've written about in journalism, their voices are definitely not heard. They're probably some of the most oppressed people in the country because they're a minority within a minority within a minority. They're in the prison system. They're such a minuscule part of it that they're really ignored within the prison system. So one story that I wrote, which was like a year-long investigation, was women in prison with breast, ovarian, and cervical cancer. Just a question of how do they get treatment? Because the women's health needs in prison are very different from men's health needs, but men are the standard in prison, as
right.
in the military.
Women are almost an afterthought.
Yeah, absolutely. So
I want to pick up on something that you said, but you're a minority, aren't you? Because there are not very many women playwrights.
Well, I think the name of this show is 51%. So there are many women playwrights. The problem is that we have been underrepresented in the theater. 40% or more of the Dramatists Guild are women. But 20% of the new productions are by women, by the most serious calculations, probably maybe less, and very few at the upper echelons. So we're a minority in terms of the public presentation and public face of theater.
Yeah.
We're not a minority of the people who are working in theater, and women are a majority of the audience. So there's a real disparity and disconnect within the theater
but
world.
But doesn't that make you crazy? It's 2014. Why is this part of the discussion? Change this.
Right. I've been involved in the struggle to incorporate more women in theater. Since I started, one of the very first things that I did was put together a women's playwriting conference. This was in Minnesota. I think there
That's
are a couple...
That's the Tyrone Guthrie Theater, right?
The Guthrie Theater actually, I hate to say this, has a terrible record right now on women. They produced an entire season with no women. So hopefully there'll be some change happening there in the future. But the major theaters at that level have been not very accommodating to women. So where women are represented, it's at the smaller theaters and the independent venues. I think there are two or three things that happen. One is where you have seen change happen for women and for people of color and other minorities, it's been because the law has pushed them. There have been equal opportunity laws and affirmative action laws that have forced institutions to make change. There isn't one that applies to the theater because it's left to independent decision-making, artistic decisions. So there hasn't been that kind of pressure that there has been in other areas. The second thing is I think there was a trajectory of change happening, slow, but things were moving forward. But I think things got stuck around 2001, and we became a very masculine-oriented society. We also had George Bush, who was actively defunding programs that helped women, whether it was in domestic violence, whether it was contracts for women. But there was an antipathy towards women and women's issues that filtered down from the top at the same time that we were engaged in these massive war actions around the world that heightened the male role, you know, the traditional male warrior role. And that filtered down through society. So things stopped around that time. That growth stopped. And it's not just playwrights. It's in every area of the arts, women, visual artists, it's composers. It's, you know, all kinds of people that are affected by these cultural attitudes. So it's frustrating. I mean, I think often a lot of Langston Hughes, you know, what happens to a dream deferred. There are generations of women who in the theater and music who haven't had the opportunity to reach their full potential. Now there's groups coming behind them who have been equalized in school and suddenly are pushed into the real world where they don't have those laws to protect them and are suddenly finding that they're drowning. So, you know, the change I think is going to be slow and it's going to take a lot of awareness building. Most people aren't really aware of playwrights or what they do or even that they exist.
Or that there's a problem. I mean, maybe people don't even think twice about the fact that this play was not written by a woman or not directed by a woman. Then there's a whole other issue of roles for women as well.
It makes me want to change it. So I think change comes from dissatisfaction. I don't really understand it. When I came to the theater, I'd already been a journalist and a lawyer. And immediately I was like, I don't understand why there aren't more women that are active, being produced. You know, in my little group of Jerome Fellows, there were two of us. And I remember talking to the Jerome Foundation about why they weren't doing more. And they were like, oh, it'll happen over time. But it hasn't happened. And there needs to be more thoughtful, considerate efforts to give women opportunities. I know there's a lot of talk about equal pay, and I like to go to some of these equal pay forums and say, but what about equal opportunities, where it's not even an issue of pay? Because nobody,
you have to get to that point.
Yeah. I mean, in the theater, nobody's being paid a lot. There are very few people who are getting wealthy. You know, it's not just about the pay. It's about the opportunities to get our voices out, to be a part of the cultural discussion. I mean, what the theater has done in some areas, for example, with AIDS, HIV/AIDS, the theater was a major player in changing the cultural attitude.
Because it got hit very hard by this disease.
It got hit very hard, and there were a number of people who were given funding, who were given venues to present theater, whether it's Angels in America or The Normal Heart. You could list, you could give a long list. There has been nothing like that that applies to human rights of women in the U.S. or around the world. But so that level of consciousness has been missing from the theater. You know, we tend to think of theater people as liberal, but they haven't really paid attention to how women are affected and how the theater can then pay back, can affect the culture. And that's where my frustration comes. I'm not just about equalizing opportunities, but I'm about enhancing the voices of women so that we can achieve full human rights for women in the U.S. and around the world. That's been the one thing that probably unites all my work.
We're so grateful for you to
have
a voice.
Well, thank you for giving me a voice.
It was really great to get to know you and cover all this territory. Cindy, I love that quote, and I think it works. I don't know if it's possible to change the world with words, but you sure as hell have tried, and we're grateful to you for that.
Thank you.
Join us for another edition of the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. I'm Sandy Klein.
Thanks for listening to the 51% Conversations with Creative Women. For show comments and suggestions, please follow us on Twitter at Sandy Klein Show. You can also find us on Facebook at The 51% Conversations. The show is produced and recorded by Chad Dugatz at the Hangar Studios in New York City. Sandy Klein is our executive producer.